The Chris Perullo Show's coverage of Search Engine Strategy San Jose was brought to you by MSN Search. Find something today at search.msn.com.
In walking the floor at Search Engine Strategies, you kind of get used to seeing the same things over and over again, especially in the booths. You know, email, campaigns, and search engine optimization strategies, yada, yada, yada. But one booth in particular stood out and actually heralded the words that I'd been looking for the entire time. Actually, three letters. RSS. And that booth happened to belong to LookSmart. And as I started asking more questions, someone started answering them. And that someone happened to be the CEO of the company, David Hills. We immediately set up a time to do a phone interview not long after the show had ended to find out a little bit more about where LookSmart has been and where it's headed. But I started the interview by asking one very important question. Why was LookSmart at this SES?
Well, you know, I've only been here for 10 months, so I'm not quite sure what the company used to go to the shows for. But this time, the reason we went to the show was that we were launching the, we had just relaunched the 10 education sites, so we're actively marketing those. We launched in second quarter our publisher tool set, so we're actively marketing that, the ad center and search content, pardon me, and other things. And then, again, if you listen to my earnings call, we focused on getting every bit of the fraud out of this network. So we're obviously aggressively marketing to advertisers again because we have a very clean environment for them. When we go to shows now, it's forever, it's going to be those three themes. Vertical search for the consumer, hence advertiser. Tools for the publisher that free them from other networks so they can start to develop their own relationships with small advertisers, along with increase their audience via search results that don't have to be branded as ours. And then between the owned and operated vertical network that we're developing and all the work we've done to the syndicated ad network, a very clean and growing environment, as is evidenced by the fact that our CPCs went up between first and second quarter when we did all this work.
Now, you say you haven't been there for very long. When did you start?
I started last October, October 26th.
It's been a good year then.
Well, it's been productive. I mean, there's a lot of stuff that we had to address here as a company, and we've worked hard to address that. You know, the company is arguably, depending on what analyst model you're looking at, half the size that I got here than when I got here. But I determined, and the board was in sync with this, that what we really had to do was we had to build a sustainable business in the direction the company had been going, which did include kind of a fractured consumer search plan and an ad network that none of us would be proud of, wasn't going to be productive. So what we did as a company, you know, and I've done two of these turnarounds thus far prior to this one, is that you really make a very, very early choice as to when you come upon things that you have to change, whether you're going to change them all at once or incrementally. And life's lessons in this have taught me that the best thing you can do is change them all at once.
Oh, wow.
And get it all out of the way. So we've got, you know, 125 people here that the people that have been here for 4 or 5 years say it's never been this busy in the company. Because we're just, everything that we have to address, getting the fraud out of the ad network, developing and defining vertical search via find, save, and share, which is our consumer brand premise, and pushing the publisher tools out so that we can gain a lot of traction in the tools market as publishers decide that they want to rent somebody's ad center and have their own advertiser relationships and search and grow their search audience by using our results. We're doing all those three things at once.
Now, you say find, save, and share. What part of the acquisition of Ferrell was part of that?
Save and share.
Okay.
So when you go to any of our education sites, what will happen is, and you start moving through the site and you start accessing different articles or different search results that we have in there, you'll see three boxes on the left-hand side. The top box is find. And that's a constrained set of article searches based on, you know, an automated process that has a little bit of a review by you know, literally two people, not two people per vertical, but just two people in total. Then, as you move through the site and you start to read articles, the article will be saved in the save box for you. And if you decided that that was something that you wanted to permanently save in your Ferrell folder, one button click.
Wow.
One button click. Even if you've never been a Furl user before, what we'll do is we'll all we ask you for is a username and an email address.
Well, that's pretty standard though with those kind of things.
But no. Other companies are expecting from the consumer a fair amount of personal information: name, address, city, state, zip, that kind of stuff. And I don't like personalization. I do like customization tools that make it easy for people to work. And then as you move through, as you move to the share box, every time that you do a search, what comes up are Furled pages that other Furl members have put in their filing cabinets that are relevant to the keywords that you're searching on. So if you and I are both golf aficionados and I type in Scottish golf courses, what I'll get is I'll get the travel publications that we have relationships with and the articles that are relevant to those. You'll get the ability to save any of those that you think are relevant. And then if I've put in if I've put in Scottish golf courses and you've furled a really good article on Scottish golf courses, that's available to me, though I don't know who you are. So we, maintain anonymity with people.
This sounds like it's going very well then,
we're extremely excited about it. Early days for all of it. In that we've just relaunched the education vertical with all the functionality on it.
Yeah, could you explain that, David?
Sure. We started with what we did in first and second quarter was prove to ourselves. Let me back up for a second. If you think about our company, we've got $61 million in the bank, so money's not an issue to us. Right, we're burning through $1.5 million, $2 million a quarter. We've just got a ton of runway from that perspective, right? So we've got that piece of it handled. Look smart, regardless of whether it's tried to attract an audience over the course of the years or not, or been successful at it when they've attempted to, has operated like a search engine from an infrastructure, personnel, technology standpoint, regardless of whether we were trying to do something with the output product from that, right? Mm-hmm. So so we've got the personnel and the technology to do it. All we're doing now is we're taking those things and we're stitching them into one seamless plan that, for the first time in the company's history, at least what I'm told, has everything in a logical order, utilizing all of the company's assets, and we've just got everybody driving really, really hard to get this stuff out as quickly as possible. So as you see things develop from us, and you see us take stances on things, it's all very well timed and very well orchestrated because we've got a strategy, and then we've got a very long-term project plan underneath that. We'll adjust the tactics underneath the project plan from time to time based on what we see happen. But the vertical search for consumers, a clean and growing ad network, and publisher technology tools that are relevant and impactful to them will absolutely be this company's strategy on a going forward basis.
This is a pretty big space. Who do you consider as your competition?
It's interesting. A bunch of people have asked me that. Anybody who's operated online companies as I have for 11 years knows that this industry really has a very different sense and definition of overall competition. I mean, you could have people that you compete with that you actually do business with. I think when you get a little more granular than that, what you find is that it really depends on the vertical. Right, there are going to be some verticals that I compete against some folks in, and those companies won't be existent in other verticals that I'm in. From a publisher tool standpoint, that varies because everybody's got different pieces of a platform. We seem to be the only one thus far that has a total content and technology platform. But again, from time to time I'll compete with other people with ad centers that'll license them to publishers. Other times I'll compete against other search engines that'll license content to publishers. And then on the on the ad network side, we compete with everybody that's selling advertising to the extent that they're in that particular vertical. So it's an interesting array of competitors, and we've actually started now to look at the individual business segments and sub-segments of our company in order to ascertain in a particular situation who our competitor is. So that's been a huge sea change for this place.
How would you, in approaching someone who had heard of LookSmart before and didn't realize that it's undergone this many changes, how would you pitch the company to them?
It's very, 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 very simple. What we do as a company, regardless of what you look at, is we provide the essential versus the exhaustive, meaning that we can provide you, if you're a consumer, search results that are essential versus exhaustive for a passion, a need, or a repetitive task that you have, because we drill into a particular topic in a way that the broad search engines don't. We're essential versus exhaustive with advertisers in that we continue to find better ways to cut up our audience and our distributed network audience for them so that they can get closer to the consumer that they absolutely want to get close to. And we're essential versus exhaustive with the publishers in that we've got a complete tool set, though we don't sell it as one platform unless the publisher wants to buy it that way. So we really focus on taking a look at a market segment and figuring out what the essential demand is. Not what the total demand of the marketplace is, but what's that part of the demand that we think is going to have the greatest growth and that we have the assets to penetrate the quickest. So to us, everything we do is segmentation.
You had talked about being in this game, if you will, for 11 years. What brought you to LookSmart? I mean, in total, what brought you to LookSmart?
The plan that we're putting forth now. I was a 25-year resident in New York City, so this was a big move for me and my family to move to California. And I spent 6 months talking to the board to make sure that they and I were in sync, which we are in perfect lockstep. And the things that drew me to the company were the, first of all, where I saw the industry going in 3 to 5 years, you know, in terms of becoming increasingly verticalized, not unlike the metamorphosis that you saw in television from broadcast television to cable, which I worked through back in the early 80s. So clearly it was the asset base that they had in order to mount an effort against that. The cash in the bank and the fact that the company has no debt on its balance sheet. It's a very nice way to get up in the morning. The fact that we had a lot of commercial content in terms of numbers of advertisers coming out of the MSN relationship. The fact that as I looked at different research, LookSmart had good consumer unaided brand recall and no definition. So I knew that we could redefine it. I felt that the OPEX base was adequate in terms of its total size and skill set to be able to pull a plan like this off. And then I really had to make sure that the board was really keen for what's going to be an awful lot of work over the next couple of years. And when all of those check boxes came up positive, I knew that this was the right place for me.
Well, and you made note of the fact that it's a nice way to get out of bed. What is the thing that gets you out of bed every day? What do you enjoy so much about going into work?
Oh, boy. This is my third turnaround situation since I retired from Cox in 2001. And taking something that's not working well and getting it to work well, have a mission, a purpose, and have a lot of energy going on in the operation, I think is probably the one single thing that I enjoy the most. I love when operations I'm involved with start to gain the momentum like this company's gaining right now. I don't know why, it's just something that really turns me on. So there's that aspect of it. What follows that momentum and passion that you develop inside of the organization is a really, really interesting path where not everything is clear to you, but it doesn't change the focus on your strategy. So I guess the unknowns that you run into, I always find very, very exciting. And then creating value for whoever owns us is something that I get really excited about, because the ability to take something that other people have had difficulty with and with the same assets creating great value from it is something that you're really proud of over the course of time. And then we also have here, obviously, the consumer proposition, which we're all excited about, being able to rebuild LookSmart into a known consumer brand. So those are the kind of things that get me out of bed in the morning. I think the thing I'm most urgent about, which would be a logical question, so I'll ask and answer it if that's okay.
Sure.
The thing that I'm most urgent about in this company is the use of time. If you think about LookSmart's history, it's kind of checkered from a success standpoint. Tremendous initial success, then too much focus and concentration on MSN, and then a huge problem that fell from the dissolution of that relationship. And what I said to the board, the board said, you know, what's the thing that you're most concerned with in coming to this company? It was simple. I remember looking at them all and just saying, time. Right? I want to make sure that quickly we identify what needs to be fixed. We quickly identify where we think the upside opportunities are, and we very quickly act on those so that people start to take a look at LookSmart, both from a commercial perspective, an investment perspective, and a consumer perspective, and say, boy, that's a pretty hot place. They've changed things quickly. So that's the thing that I think I'm most urgent about, is the judicious use of time. Everything else I got.
Now, speaking of what you have, what's your company culture like?
I think if you asked all the team members here now, they would say our culture is very busy. it's axiomatically a flat organization, which A, is my style, and B, just where companies like this have to be in order to get stuff done. I encourage. There are a couple of things that I encourage from a management perspective that I've learned to do over the course of time, and I find that stand me in good stead. There's making sure that you're not playing huddle ball, meaning that people are handing things off when their expertise stops and somebody else's expertise picks up. So, for instance, if I'm a product person and you're a technologist, at one point, the culture that I want here that we're establishing now and the team's doing very well with it is I'm going to say to you, you know what? I got this as far as I can get it. I trust you. You take it. And that means that there has to be a tremendous amount of trust built up between the team members, because in a lot of corporate cultures, what winds up happening is that product person will want to follow that process through rather than get onto something else. So there's a lot of trust built up here. And the way that you build up trust in people and have people build up trust in one another is that you encourage independent decision-making, making sure that everybody's not making decisions for the sake of making them, but, you know, with some data point that they can point to, and getting them used to making decisions. Because as they get used to making decisions, they tend to make better decisions as time goes on. They gain confidence in that. They gain confidence in their coworkers. So that's one big premise about of an organizational structure here that I've used in the past. Independent decision making with a lot of trust between team members. And then the other part is that you have to recognize and accept that mistakes are going to occur, and you actually have to encourage mistakes in an organization like ours, because if you encourage mistakes, what happens is people are less afraid to make the wrong decision. Hence, they try to make more decisions. And you remember Babe Ruth had the most home runs, but he also had the most strikeouts, right?
Yeah.
So those are the two hallmarks of what we do. Underneath that, in order to run a company like that, is that you've got to have an awful lot of data that very quickly shows you whether the decision was a right one or not. And I work very hard, and this is the third underpinning of any organization that I've ever been in, at depersonalizing data. And what I mean by that is what we have here now is a very steady flow of different cuts of data depending on who you are and what you're doing. And it's just pushed at you constantly. And the reason that I've learned that you do it that way is that when you personalize data, which means that I bring it to you, I'm going to, you know, most people open up a conversation with, I have good news and bad news, right? So we don't open up conversations here. In fact, I snap at people when they do that. And I just say, no, you got data. And the data was a result from some effort. and the data either supports the effort you put out or didn't. I don't care whether it did or it didn't. I only care that we know that and don't make the same mistake twice if it did not. So those three things, and if you talk to senior management here, I think you would hear them echo that stuff, creates a very open environment where there's an awful lot of innovation, zero politics, and you know, a culture where innovation is rewarded because mistakes are okay.
That's interesting. I don't know of many CEOs who would take that approach.
Yeah, you know, I guess because this is my third turnaround, you know, you just, it's very different. I work for Cox Enterprises, one of the finest companies on the face of this earth for 21 years. Very experimental in their, you know, in their approach to things, but in a very, very different situation. So they're more structured than I can be. I think Google, and not to pick on them, but another company that's met with huge success because they're exceptional operators, probably now from time to time says, how do we manage how big we are? Because we're moving away a little bit from that entrepreneurial run-and-gun environment. So I think I think if I was the CEO of a company that was 25 times my size, I would hope that I would keep some of the underpinnings, but I think there would have to be a little bit more structure around things.
That begs the question, do you feel, I mean, beyond being limited by time, do you feel you're limited by size, or is size one of your strengths at this point?
Size is something that you have to just determine to turn into a strength. I don't have a complex of size versus other large companies. What you were alluding to, is I say, well, okay, I'm small and nimble. I can make decisions quickly. I can impact things really quickly. How do I use that as a tool to get things done faster, under the assumption that time is the most precious asset that I have to conserve?
What was the biggest, I don't know if I want to use the word shock, but what was the biggest thing that you noticed between living on the East Coast in New York versus living on the West Coast San Francisco?
Well, I've had operations on the West Coast. I am new to the West Coast. So I've had to work at building up a network of men and women at my level. I think one positive surprise I've had, because, you know, your network is usually how you find your people, is that we've been able to attract surprisingly easily very, very good people. So you know, I think I've been pleasantly surprised by that. You know, I guess every so often I get to a point where if I was in New York and I needed something, I would know exactly who to call. And out here, I've got to struggle with it a little bit still because I've only been here for 10 months. You know, not much else other than that. I think if this operation were in New York, it wouldn't be run substantially differently.
Oh.
People would talk funny, but, you know.
Well, that happens no matter where you go, I guess.
Yeah.
Well, I know you're a busy man, Dave, and I really appreciate the time you've taken with us.
Thanks, Chris.
Yeah.
And look forward to talking to you again.
Oh, without a doubt. Thank you.
Have a good day.
You too.
This interview brought to you by the all-new MSN Search. Find something today at search.msn.com. Visit thechrisparulloshow.com for more audio downloads, and remember to tune in every Thursday night for our live show.